So what he was talking about here was not a viscosity in the way we normally think about viscosity in the laboratory, but an eddy viscosity, a process in the sense of Kolmogorov, where you take a large-scale fluid motion and cascade the kinetic energy from the large-scale motions to progressively small-scale motions. If you just think of it, though, as a viscosity in the way you would insert it in the equation of motion, the Navier-Stokes equation, then you can work out what expected Q is needed, and you can work out what viscosity, kinematic viscosity, is needed. And you need about 10 to the power 10 centimeters squared per second to make this picture work, to get Q of order 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. Just to remind you, in these units, water, ordinary water, has a viscosity of 10 to the minus 2, 12 orders of magnitude smaller. And Bill Hubbard noticed that if you were to take the largest scale in the problem, which approaches 10 to the power of 10 centimeters, and multiply it by the characteristic convective velocity that we think pertains to the inside of Jupiter, which is about 1 centimeter per second, you actually get this number. But, of course, there's a problem, which Goldreich and Nicholson pointed out, which is, of course, that those motions have a characteristic time scale of decades, immensely long compared to the tidal period. And so what you have to visualize is that you've got this very slow large-scale circulation, and you've got this tidal wiggle, and that won't couple. You can't expect this viscosity to work at the tidal periods. You have to instead match the motions at the tidal period to find the effective viscosity at that period, and that means that you have to go way down this Kolmogorov cascade to the smaller scale motion. Rotation actually probably plays a role as well. But anyway, you have to go to small scale motions, and those small scale motions have a corresponding viscosity that is smaller by about 8 orders of magnitude, and so you end up with a tidal Q that is perhaps 10 to the 12 or something like that. So this idea does not work, but I want you to keep in mind this number, because if there were any way of getting that by some other process, that's one way to get Q.
Dave, can I just make a comment that in stellar binaries, for systems where the inequality is such that the motion of the convective cells is faster than actually
then it works.
This is pretty
or
much
might work.
I mean, now that the observations are such, it pretty well shows that it's
good.
It works. Mm-hmm. So just a.
But using mixing ranks,
do you mean? Yeah. Demo. So in wide binaries where you can actually check it, it does work pretty well.
Okay. Yeah. That's circularization versus just
circular. That's circularization.
Stan Dermot in 1979 said the following. Suppose, as many people think, Jupiter has a central core of heavy elements, and suppose that the Q of that central core is small, like say 10, make it about as small as you could imagine, which would be appropriate if solid matter at or near the melting point probably helps to be in the partially molten region. We know from laboratory experiments that if you take a squishy solid, meaning something that is already perhaps a little bit molten, but not so molten that the liquid separates from the solid, and just flex it, it's highly dissipated. And the reason is partly the phase transition relationship between liquid and solid. In some cases, it's purely fluid dynamical. The liquid literally has to be squeezed along channels between the solid grains. But for whatever reason, it can be highly dissipated. You can then go back to the way that Q was defined. And remember, it's a lumped parameter. It's not necessarily associated with each element of the system, each fluid element, and ask, how does a low Q in the central core translate into the required Q for the system as a whole? And because of the fifth power of the size of the body that enters into the tidal response, what you suffer in the way that Q is defined is a factor of 10 to the 5 arising from the likelihood that the radius of the core, the solid or partially solid core, is a factor of 10, roughly, smaller than the radius of Jupiter itself. And so you, instead of having a Q of 10, which pertains just to that central small volume, you end up with a Q of perhaps 10 to the 6. It's a little bit more complicated because the tidal response is involves a numerical factor, which is not trivial, which actually is, I call it an amplification factor because it actually makes Q smaller, which Dan did look at and helps a little. We don't know whether there even is a core, let alone its state. But in order for this to work, you don't want it to be either a cold solid or a liquid, right? Because a cold solid, in the normal way of thinking about it, is not highly dissipative. It's closer to elastic. And a liquid is also not dissipative because typically viscosities are too low. So you want it somewhere in between. And this is well known from laboratory experience that if you take any material and just plot Q as a function of temperature, it reaches a minimum near the melting point. Just to put this in context for condensed matter physicists in the audience, it's a challenge to you. I want you to accept this challenge. What is the melting point? We don't know. And these are quite high pressures. The standard models for Jupiter give a basal pressure of the hydrogen region of around 40 megabars. It varies a little bit from model to model, but actually that's not a highly sensitive parameter. It's typically about 40 or so megabars. The temperature at the base of the hydrogen region is somewhat uncertain, somewhere in this range, somewhat uncertain, in part because of the radiator zone that Tristan Guyot has, and also because of the possibility of a plasmic phase transition. You know, we don't know whether the entropy, in other words, we don't know whether the entropy here is the same as the entropy in the atmosphere. It's easy to show that the central pressure of Jupiter itself can be much larger than 50 megabars, even though the core is only a small fraction of the mass. And that, you can see that just by writing down hydrostatic equilibrium and noticing that the pressure difference across that core is quadratic in the density of that core, and the density of the core can easily be 20 grams per cc, whereas the overlying hydrogen is only 4 grams per cc. So you get a big amplitude. So you can actually be way over here. It can be above 100 megabars, right at the center of Jupiter, depending on how big the core is. Of course, if you don't have that core, you're way back over here at 40 to 50. So we have this box that I've drawn that represents the uncertainty of the bottom of what I call the Jupiter 80 band, although it may not really be an 80 band. And it may even be a bigger uncertainty than that, but this is sort of the ballpark. Then there's a question of what the melting point is for materials like iron, perovskite. We don't even know whether perovskite is a stable phase of 50 megabars, do we wrong? I wouldn't think so. But with your computer, you can easily tune in 50 megabars. Yes, that's right. But that's the nice thing about theory. I mean, 50 megabars is just as easy as 5.
Have you used any of the standard melting laws?
Yes. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about right here. For example, you can take Lindemann. One way of writing Lindemann is that d log t melting d log rho is twice gamma minus the third. This gamma is the thermodynamic Grunheisen parameter. There are several different ways of proving this. If you haven't seen it before, I'd be happy to tell you more about it, but it's a nice way of thinking about Lindemann's law. The 80 bat is just gamma itself. So this is a way of thinking about the relative slopes of the 80 bat and the melting curve. Gamma, if gamma is greater than 2/3, the melting curve is steeper than the 80 bat. The craziest state is moderately well known. You can patch what we have already onto Thomas Fermi or whatever you like. And then there's a question of what you think gamma is. You could use free volume theory. You can play around. And so this red curve was not just something I drew at random. It's something that is actually based on this kind of calculation. I don't believe it, but I'm just using this to give you a ballpark feeling. This red curve comes in. This red, I didn't draw it quite far enough, but it's actually designed to match onto what we think the inner core of the Earth is, sort of 5 or 6,000 at 3 megabars. So there is a tie point down in here for this red curve. And there's a bigger uncertainty about perovskite, so don't take that curve too seriously. That's why I've got double question marks. We don't even know whether perovskite exists, or whatever it is. But that's the challenge. The point is, it's not ridiculous that it could be solid. That's the point of this diagram. But it's an open question. It's an interesting question. I would judge that Dermot's idea is at best marginal. In other words, you really have to push everything in the right direction to get Q down to what we need. And it's likely to fail.
How could there not be a core?
Sorry, how?
How could there not be a core?
What do you mean by
you think somehow everything would just be visible and just continue?
Oh, well, that's a fascinating question. Two comments about that. The first is that under these conditions, given the immense dilution potentially available from hydrogen, we've got to remember that. And we're talking about a system that's overwhelmingly hydrogen by number. I think it's possible that everything is soluble.
Everything's soluble in hydrogen?
I think it's possible. I'm not saying I know that. I think it's possible that everything's soluble in metallic hydrogen, given that all the elements individually could be metallic. And given the immense dilution, 10 to the 4 dilution, remember that in the Gibbs energy that decides whether something is soluble, there's a KT log X, where X is mole fraction. KT is large, thermal energy is large, so the entropy of mixing term in the free energy is very large in the direction of favoring solubility. So if you get your mind around that aspect of the problem, you realize very quickly that you've got to have enormous energies driving you towards making diamond or metallic carbon or whatever it is you want to settle out. That's hard to do. See, this is now 2 electron volts. KT log X is often 10, 15 electron volts for these elements. And that's an energy favoring mixing with hydrogen. It is also true, however, that if you made a core first and then put the hydrogen on top, then it's not just a solubility question, it's a convection question of whether you can mix the elements up. And I've done that calculation too, and the answer is that you may not be able to mix the elements up in the age of Jupiter. Not possible to do enough work. The vigor of convection down there, in fact, it may not even convect, but even if you make the best, most favorable assumptions, it's possible that the convection is insufficiently vigorous in transporting the elements back up. So the core might persist even though it's soluble. This, by the way, is a well-known fluid dynamical phenomenon. The history of a system depends on how you put it together. In the context of what's called double diffusive convection, if I take a pot of fluid in the lab and suddenly dump a whole bunch of sugar or salt, which is heavy, do it rapidly, it'll settle to the bottom, it'll take a long time to mix back up. If I take the same amount of sugar and salt and sprinkle it gently on the water while it's convecting, I can get it well mixed. So it's a history-dependent phenomenon. It depends on whether you make the core first and then have convection, or whether you sprinkle stuff like sprinkling salt on your food, as to whether the system will be well mixed.
I'm way outside of my field here, but it's star, it involves stars, and you get cores that are...
That of course is through nuclear synthesis. So that's a completely different process.
No, but I'm saying you get like a carbon core or something.
That's nuclear synthesis.
Right, I know, but it doesn't mix. Oh, you said that's just a matter of mixing time.
Oh, well, actually some of those objects are not convective anyway through to the center. I mean, the sun, for example, is not convective except in a shell. So you have to think, and actually in the case of the sun, people do think about other mixing processes. But basically, the issue is what part of the body is convective, and you know, and how is material made.
Jupiter would be convective down to the center.
Jupiter in the standard picture, and indeed this is true of brown dwarfs as well, has a tendency to be convective all the way to the center. Of course, if you have a molecular weight gradient, you can turn off the convection. So you have to. I mean, but in terms of the dominant constituent, which is hydrogen, if you just make a Jupiter out of cosmic stuff, it will tend to be convective, except maybe for a small conductive core.
It's got to be strong enough there to separate, even if you have a single fluid going down that's separated by atomic weight. I mean, would you put iron towards the center just
No.
Potential gradient?
No. If you, for objects like Jupiter and brown dwarfs, the diffusive separation is exceedingly weak because the convective motions overwhelm it. There are counterexamples. White dwarfs are a counterexample. The sun also does a small amount of separation of helium from its convective zone to the deep interior. The separation process that works in giant planets is raindrop formation. That one will work because then you're making a macroscopic entity whose Stokes fall velocity can compete with convection. But diffusion is inefficient. So what I'm saying is that brown dwarfs and giant planets are like the Earth's troposphere. The atmosphere outside here is well mixed in the bottom layer. There is, of course, if you get high enough in the Earth's atmosphere, an elemental separation. What matters there is the vigor of the motions that are mixing, but also the thickness of the layer. The layer is relatively thin so that you can do this barodiffusion. But you don't normally think of a separation by diffusion as being important for the same reason that you don't for the S core. So the S core, nobody talks about sulfur diffusing to the top of the core in a liquid mixture of iron and sulfur. Why don't they do that? Because we think it's convecting.
Yeah.
And the convection wins for reasonable diffusivities. Yeah.
A couple of comments, if I may, on this melting issue. The first is that what I had in mind by the melting law was something like the Simon law. People have checked these over, I would say, quite reasonable kinds of pressure, not on your scale, but on things that you do well. And the parameters of those things can be fixed by, for instance, the shock gradient, the highest pressures and temperatures that have gone. But the second issue is that I think one would probably expect a sequence of melting point maxima again.
Sure.
Because of the fact that as you go up to these pressures, you're beginning to strip off electrons from the core.
Yep.
And you see that very clearly already in simple things like cesium.
Yep.
So
sure.
What consequence would that have on the cube if you had melting point maximum working on it?
You can certainly write down a formula in the spirit of the parameter that people use in OCP, where you get a z to the 5/3 dependence, and then the question is, what is the valence? Yes, you can do that, and this could even be. It's not clear whether these are sufficiently high pressures, but you're right in general. Actually, I did look at that a little bit, and typically what happens is that this kind of recipe tends to overestimate the slope within each range. So it might not be so bad as sort of an envelope. In other words, in some sense, if you thought of it like this, what it really is doing is this. But it's still sort of doing the same thing overall.
It's not completely clear to me, David, that it will just keep turning it. Something like that might be possible too.
Well, if you really thought that, if you really thought that what mattered was something like this, I'm not sure I've got it completely right, but I think it's something like that. That will keep going up. That'll keep going up. It is a gentle slope eventually because Z will saturate. So eventually you can't make this any bigger. But this is still giving you a density to the one-third behavior, so it's still giving you a slope to the melting curve. Yes. Yeah, but you see, RS still gets smaller as you go to. So this kind of recipe never gives a melting point that goes down. It will always give a melting point that goes up. But it's true that for a fixed Z, this gives a very gentle slope. And in fact, hydrogen, metallic hydrogen, is one of those materials that has the peculiarity that the melting curve is less steep than the 80 bat, which is not typical of earth-forming materials. Normally we think of the melting curve as being steeper than the 80 bat. But the melting curve, I mean, this is density one-third, and if you think about this, that's, well, one way to say it is that in hydrogen, from OCP or slightly better calculations, this is typically about 0.6 in hydrogen, metallic hydrogen. You may recall, and I think in the extreme high pressure limit it goes to 0.5. So there's a limit for this to 0.5. And so this will actually give you a value that's less than gamma. So the melting curve is less steep, but if you're changing Z, then you'll have this jog as you strip electrons off.
Even if you have the melting curve crossing the 80 bat or the temperature profile inside Dupuytren's core, it's a way to maximize dissipation, right, in the core?
In the core, yes. Well, you know, this of course is just Jupiter hydrogen.
Yes.
The question of what the core does is dictated by how the heat comes out of the core. If you thought that the core was solid, then what you would do is that you would have a thermal boundary layer in the core to get the radiogenic and perhaps tidal heat out of the core. You'd have a thermal boundary layer just like the Earth, and then you'd run onto an 80 bat inside the rocky core, which is dictated by the viscosity. So then the recipe becomes one closely related to the way you do a calculation for the temperature profile in the Earth, with the difference, however, that this is actually a fairly high heat flow, because the radiogenics in a 5 Earth mass rocky core confined to that higher density, I mean, that actually corresponds to a fairly high heat flow, just for radioactivity. So that can actually drive the system up close to the melting point, provided it was below the melting point to begin with. Okay. So that's one idea that hasn't been shot down completely, although, as I said, it is tough to make it work. Let me describe briefly an idea that I published back in the 80s, which has to do with the effect of a first-order phase transition. And it goes under the title anomalous viscosity, which is a terminology that you will find if you go and look at Landau-Lifschitz. As some of you know, Landau-Lifschitz has absolutely everything if you know where to look. Sometimes in footnotes.
Sometimes your problem that you think you've solved is a homework problem.
Yeah, that's right. Here's the idea, the basic idea. I'm not going to take you through all the math. It's not worth your time. So the basic idea is that inside of these giant planets, you have insolubility of helium and hydrogen, limited solubility of helium and hydrogen. The planet is steadily cooling through geologic time, and so there's a continuous creation of new raindrops, droplets that will grow by diffusion from the surrounding fluid, and upon reaching an appropriate size, which is of order a millimeter, can then settle by Stokes flow, by Stokes rainout, to the deeper interior where they will merge, presumably in some region that's helium rich. The details of which we do not understand because we don't know the phase diagram. So the basic condensed matter physics question is what is the actual phase diagram of the hydrogen helium system? But for this purpose, the essential idea is limited solubility, raindrop formation.
Can I just check one point here? They're forming at a region of a certain density of metallic hydrogen, and then settling into a region where the density of metallic hydrogen is higher?
Yes. But the important point actually is that in the simplest version of it, they will dissolve at some greater depth. If they don't dissolve, you can actually make a helium layer, or even a helium core. But that will, the issue of the final fate doesn't affect this model. At any instant, therefore, just as in real clouds in the Earth's atmosphere, there will be some spectrum of sizes, some droplets have formed recently, some that are on their way down already. So there'll be a population of raindrops. You then have your tidal disturbance, which causes a fluctuation. It's actually a fairly weak fluctuation in pressure. The tidal disturbance doesn't strongly couple to the pressure, but there is a fluctuation in pressure so that the equilibrium state of these droplets relative to their surroundings will have changed. And the reason, of course, is that the phase boundary for the insolubility of helium will, in general, be different from the adiabat. So if I take and this is just like a bubble chamber or any other phenomenon you know of where you have nucleation. If I disturb the system by an adiabatic disturbance, you will shift it away from the equilibrium state at the surface of these droplets, either in the direction of making the droplets want to grow slightly or in the direction of making them want to become a little bit smaller. And in fact, of course, it will oscillate back and forth between one and the other. So the helium raindrops will grow and decline in radius as the pressure fluctuates caused by the tidal disturbance. Now, the crucial thing is, of course, that the growth and decline of raindrop size is not in phase with the pressure fluctuation. Why? Because it is dictated by diffusion into and out from the surface of the droplet, diffusion at the atomic level of helium. So you have to solve the time-dependent diffusion problem, which is what I did, for how the droplets grow and decline. And diffusivity, of course, is an intrinsically irreversible, that is, dissipative process.
Is there any estimate of the size of this
office? The size that's important for this model is of order 1 millimeter. But it also turns out to be important what the spacing of the droplets is. I'll explain that in a moment.
The neutral helium atoms somewhere in the outer layers of the planet, how deep have to go in before the helium starts ionizing? Or does it ever happen in Jupiter?
I'm imagining that this happens at of order a megabar or a few megabars pressure, where the hydrogen is starting to produce conduction electrons, the helium is not ionized. And I think that's the most likely circumstance for insolubility. As you know, and as I did in my PhD thesis work, even when it's fully ionized, there is an insolubility. But the best circumstance for helium insolubility, in my opinion, is the one where helium is not ionized, but the hydrogen is. Because then you have this strongly repulsive pseudopotential between the conduction electrons and the tightly bound core states of the helium. But of course, that's a condensed matter physics problem that, in my opinion, has never been properly solved. And so it's a challenge for you guys in that community to do that problem properly.
What temperatures are we talking about here?
5,000, 10,000, so somewhere in that ballpark. Yeah, an RS of order 1.
You are saying that the diffusion time in the object is about a millimeter at 10,000 Kelvin. Is longer than the tidal time.
You're jumping ahead of my argument. Just wait a few minutes. It's not that simple. I will tell you, though, that the diffusivity, I believe, is not unusual. It's like, say, 10 to the minus 4 centimeters squared per second, which is not that much different than the diffusivity if I put something in water. I don't, of course, know that, but that's not the biggest problem with this kind of modeling. I mean, if you come along and say that diffusivity is 10 times larger, it's not going to change the model much. Yeah?
Could you elaborate on this argument that it's not in phase? I didn't quite understand that.
Because of diffusion.
And is it very slow? Is diffusion very slow?
This is what I was asking.
You've got a second order differential equation which has a single time derivative and space derivative. If you think about putting an oscillation in, you will always get an out of phase effect. It's a fundamental property of diffusion. Diffusion is fundamentally dissipative, and therefore there is fundamentally always a phase difference between the application of a disturbance and the response. That's a property of every diffusive system. Just write down the equation. You'll see immediately that that's going to be. I mean, I didn't write it down. I'm sorry, but it's a very elementary thing. And I urge you to look at Landau and Lipschitz. They have a beautiful 2 pages.
If you can find it.
Is that the fluid dynamics book?
That would be too obvious.
Yes, it's in the fluid dynamics one, not the statistical mechanics. Sometimes you don't know where to look, I agree, because they don't always put things in the most obvious place. But they actually have a section called anomalous diffusion or anomalous viscosity or anomalous dissipation. And this is a phenomenon that's well known for the dispersion of sound waves going through foamy material and so forth. And so volcanologists are well aware of this. A question that you must ask for this phenomenon is, what is the best circumstance I can think of for making this work? I'm not saying that's what you've got, but it's useful to think about the best, that is, the optimal circumstance. And the optimal circumstance is one where the droplets are neither too frequent nor too sparse. By frequent and sparse, I really mean spacing. No, frequent means lots and lots of droplets per unit volume. Sparse means droplets widely spaced. If the droplets are too close to each other, and you have to take my word for it, I just didn't want to deluge you with the math, because it takes a lot of analysis to work this, but it's all published. If the droplets are too close to each other, then the diffusive response of the system saturates the intervening volume between the droplets so that you can get back to equilibrium on the tidal time scale. So the spacing of the droplets turns out to be important, as well as the size of the droplets. So diffusion will then equilibrate the space between the droplets, and that will reduce the supersaturation or subsaturation. On the other hand, if you make the droplets too far apart, then you're doing your dissipation in a region around each droplet, and most of the volume is not dissipating at all. So I think it should be obvious that if I make the system too sparse, then the dissipation again will be reduced. And so the ideal circumstance turns out to be the one, and this is not obvious, it's just but you know, all the analysis has been done. The ideal circumstance does turn out to be the one where you have the spacing of the droplets exactly such that you are beginning to have an interference, if you will, between the time-dependent diffusive solution around one droplet and around another. And the way to express that, or a way to express that, is in terms of the diffusive flux into or out of a particular droplet, and how much, this is diffusion of helium in hydrogen, delta X, some supersaturation or subsaturation, the diffusive flux into or out of a droplet in a tidal period, 1/1 the tidal frequency, and compare that with the supersaturation spread out of the entire volume that each droplet can own, so to speak, before it's in the domain of the next droplet. So this is diffusivity, this is the gradient, so this is the diffusive flux per unit area, this is the areas of the surface of the droplet. I should remind you, by the way, that the three-dimensional solution to the diffusion equation, equilibrium solution, has a 1 upon r drop-off. So the supersaturation drops off as 1 upon r. That's very important to the way it behaves. And so this gives you an optimal frequency that involves the diffusivity, the size of the droplet, and the number density of the droplet. You can see that this has the right dimensions.
David, what's the, just in relative terms, these droplets are forming at a certain pressure. What you call the fluctuation? What's the ratio of the tidal pressure fluctuation to the actual pressure?
Infinitesimal, 10 to the minus 6, something like that. So this is all in a linear regime. In particular, the theory assumes that you don't nucleate new droplets because of the tides. So I'm assuming there's sort of some background process, largely undisturbed except for this small disturbance. So everything's in the linear regime in terms of response. I assume that. I don't actually know that, but I assume that. And it's true that the tidal effects are small. If you thought that you wanted to get the optimal frequency to come out like the tidal frequency, and the tidal frequency is 10 to the minus 4, dominated by the rotation of Jupiter, these are the kinds of numbers that would work. In the paper that I published, there's a long argument about whether or not these numbers are reasonable. But the truth is, I don't know. And this is a really hard problem. I mean, this is basically cloud physics. Cloud physics is complicated. For what it's worth, there is a flux constraint in the problem that comes from the argument that a certain amount of heat is released by this process, that the helium fallout is contributing some fraction of Jupiter's heat flow, and therefore, there's a continuous creation of droplets and removal by settling. And I didn't write down the flux balance condition, but it does involve these two parameters. So it's not a completely unconstrained problem. There is a relationship, I believe, between these two parameters. I'm not at liberty to choose both of them at random. The 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 1 does happen to be about the size at which they settle out. And so these numbers do actually have some merit, roughly speaking, in terms of satisfying the flux constraint. The fact remains that this is a theory which has the property that the Q you predict is very frequency dependent, expressing the frequency in units of this optimal frequency, such that if you move away from that optimal frequency, the Q shoots up to very high values, which of course would be undesirable. And this is a three order of magnitude range in which you can make the model work, but the reality is that you can imagine choices that can make this number vary by 5-6 orders of magnitude without too much difficulty. So in that sense, I'm not really that happy with the model, because I don't have a good basis for arguing that you really are in this range. It is a fact, though, that this can do more than what you need. And I should stress in addition that it doesn't have to be helium droplets. Any phase transition with a surface energy will do this, including the plasma phase transition. Yeah?
Do you include surface tension in this model?
You don't need to. The surface tension is implicit in the sense that the droplets have to be a separated phase, yes. But surface tension doesn't play a role. It plays a role in the cloud physics because it dictates the size of droplets that remain spherical. Yeah. And once they become bigger, they disrupt. So yes, that's in there in the fluid dynamics part. But in terms of these sizes, 10 to the minus 2 centimeters, the surface energy is larger than the hydrodynamic stresses of the droplet as it's moving through the fluid. So in that sense, it's important.
If the surface tension is too high, then I don't know how much is known at these conditions. Wouldn't then droplets form at all? That's the question.
If the surface tension is very high, and if you can assume that that surface tension applies right down to the size of the original nuclei, which is a difficult issue, then you have a nucleation barrier which is severe. And then you have great difficulty. And I have speculated that the formation of helium raindrops in Jupiter might even be a storm-like phenomenon. In other words, the system supersaturates, but there are no nucleating seeds. It may actually be a very clean system at these temperatures. So there's no dust that can survive or anything like that. So the nucleation problem can be horrendous. Ed Saltpeter and I worked on this. The supersaturation required for homogeneous nucleation is large, as is usually the case, like, say, 10%. 10% is big. So you could imagine a circumstance where the system wants to nucleate new raindrops and fails to do so, and then suddenly, bang, you get a storm of nucleation, enormous energy release, and then the system settles back down, and then it has to repeat the process again, 100 million years later. So I don't really believe that. But anyway, that would be the consequence of having a very high surface energy. But even for what we expect the surface energy to be, the surface energy of metals, by the way, is high. If you want a number, it's sort of like 1,000 for metallic hydrogen, it's sort of like 1,000 ergs per square centimeter, really high. But that's typical of metals. Actually, it may be a few thousand. I forget the numbers. Anyway, it's sort of in that ballpark. Then the nucleation problem can be serious. Yeah.
What happens if you go through this exercise for the atmospheric clouds? Is the abundance of the clouds, the fact that the water is so much ammonia, is so much less abundant than hydrogen, does that sort of kill the idea?
For doing this atmosphere?
Instead of envisioning
you
drops of hydrogen, just envision particles of ammonia or water in the upper atmosphere.
It's buried in this analysis, but it is important that this happen in a substantial region, a thickness much thicker than the atmosphere, and substantial density. If you try and do the same thing in the atmosphere, where the density is 3 orders of magnitude lower, or 4 orders of magnitude lower, and the thickness is only a few hundred kilometers, then you're in trouble. That's typically what's true with tidal dissipation phenomena.
So the question of these quantities which we have shown in red, the specificity, the size of the droplets, and also the number density, they vary as temperature and density if you go up and down in the atmosphere, much more probably compared to the tidal force disturbances. Does this play a role here, or are these to be understood as some average quantity?
I'm sure that what really happens is that instead of a curve like this, you get a sort of more flat, well, I don't know what shape, but it might be spread out more and not as low. And that might even help, because of course the conditions will change from location to location. But the way the model's set up, it's confined to work than the region where the helium droplets are forming, which in this model might be, for example, you know, between 1.5 megabars and 1 megabar or something like that. I mean, you know, it's obviously, yeah, it's a shell. So it's confined to work in a shell. And that's taken into account in this calculation.
Okay. How would that change if you had a distribution radio?
Again, it'll produce a spread so that the Q will not rise as quickly, but it also won't reach as deep a minimum. By the way, this is a well-known phenomenon in the context of all kinds of dissipative models, including the Q for the Earth's mantle, where you can identify a particular mechanism with a particular relaxation time, and omega tau equals 1 is the minimum Q, but then you realize there's a whole bunch of relaxation times and characteristic times, and then the thing gets washed out and spread out. So maybe the real thing is sort of doing this. I don't know. That might even help the model. I don't know. But it's hard to... I don't know how to do cloud physics, at least not in this context. Might be worth trying to do more work on that, but I'd like to see the condensed matter part, which I think is more tractable, done. The other... Yeah?
It's hard to imagine that this model can work past the latest billion year. So it means that because phase separation probably occurred late in the evolution.
That's right. Factor, you know? That's right.
And so it means that Jupiter's tidal Q might have been much larger in the past. And I was wondering how that would agree with the evolution of Io, etc.
Well, if you, I don't think this is the only mechanism, but suppose hypothetically this was the only way of getting a Q of 10 to the 5. I'm just playing, I'll play advocate for my own model, even though I'm not really wanting to push this model strongly. Let's suppose that it was 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 by this mechanism and there was nothing else that worked. Then what you would say is that the system, that the Galilean satellite system was doing nothing interesting until the time of formation of helium raindrops, which might have been only a billion years ago, or even less maybe, although that's getting contrived. And then the system suddenly started moving fast. And from the point of view of the geological evidence, you can't exclude that possibility. There's nothing about what we see or think we understand about the Galilean satellites that precludes saying that Io only became active in the last billion years, and before that it was a boring place.
If Q were really 10 to the 3 for...
Well, that's... that's...
Like push crazy. The whole system, you know, through and, yeah, like, less than...
Well, that, no, that'd be too high. It'd be unstable. But yeah, all right. We should take a break, and then we'll have Lars talk about the other stuff. Let me just quickly tell you I'm going to flash this up, and I hope people don't get hung up on it. It's not worth getting hung up on, but it's kind of fun just to mention it briefly. Here's a model that doesn't work, but it's fun to think about. And it uses magnetic fields. I mean, you know, and I did this a long time ago, but never published it. There is, of course, a location inside Jupiter where the natural decay time of electrical currents equals the tidal period. And the reason is that the electrical conductivity declines from some high value to some very low value. This is in SI units. As you go outwards from the conducting interior towards the surface of the planet. And there's got to be some place where the decay time is the same as the tidal period. And so you can actually do, you can solve the field induced by the tides and ask where, you know, how much dissipation do you get? The dissipation is largest in this region where you have this crossover of the two periods. But it gives too high a Q. But I mention this just to point out that this is the one, this is magnetic diffusivity, it's defined in this way, 1 upon mu naught sigma. This is the one case where you can identify a microscopic dissipative effect that everyone should surely agree must happen. And so this is the best cue that I know of from an undisputable microscopic dissipative effect. Oh, 95% of the radius. This is way outside what people call the core. But it's actually lower, it's deeper than Tristan-Guyot's radiative zone. A few thousand Kelvin. Why don't we have a break? And I'll say, make some brief introductory comments about what I suspect is the best model. And then we can have Lars and Tristan. So let's reconvene at 11:30.
Neil, do you know that Seamus Davis from Berkeley is giving the physics on STL?
Okay. Well, tomorrow I think we'll certainly do it because
it'll be in Brighton.
Well, it's fine.
You're
talking about this stuff?
Yesterday.
I mean, you probably won't. We'll certainly put that on the board because those are well defined topics.
Seamus Davis,
and I know, and actually,
STM results on ITC as well.
Oh, okay.
I have to get help. But anyway, there are attempts these days to try and do the cloud physics problem.